The elders graciously granted me a sabbatical. When you're an academic, a sabbatical has an academic purpose. A book to complete, a paper to write and submit to peers for critical review, or a new course to prepare. When you're a pastor and you receive a sabbatical, the purpose is basically restorative. Doing nothing pastoral aside from recharging your batteries in the Word and rebuilding and reconnecting your relationship with your spouse. Coming out of academics a decade earlier and spending the following decade as a pastor, I ended up splitting the sabbatical time in two, the first half of which I explored a topic and the second half, which we spent a lot of time reconnecting together. I front-loaded the academic part because there was something that was bothering me in my mind and spirit for years, and I hadn't had any concentrated time to work on or think about it, and so it just niggled at me. Every time we sang a song related to the subject, I would kind of cringe inside a little bit. Every time someone prayed and said the words, I would wonder. And the question is this. Well, there's the text. We should have read that first. We'll read it in a minute. What does it mean to love God as His disciple? What does it mean to love God as His disciple? Is it something that we have to say, or is it something that we show? We sing it in songs, I love you, Lord, and I lift my voice, I love you, God. We say it sometimes in our prayers, God, we love you. And I wondered if there was any strong biblical precedent or any biblical precedent at all for saying this, like whether we're commanded to say it or not. I know that we're commanded to love God because He says, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. But is loving God something that we do, or is it something that we say? Is it something that we do where the actions speak so strongly that we would never have to say the words because they don't need to be said? My thinking on the matter was birthed by Paul's words in 2 Timothy 3 that in the last days we will become lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. I, along with other leaders, are therefore responsible for the spiritual life of this body to make sure that, first of all, you don't become lovers of pleasure. Therefore, I need to understand, or we need to understand, what pleasures are, and they can be easily enough to find in the world, especially in this country. The allure of them is obvious, active, and addictive. The other side of the coin, though, is what we are to help people move towards, and that is loving God. And therefore, we need to know what that looks like. So I wrote emails to every theologian that I knew and every seminary that I was acquainted with, asking them to send me their best 5 books on what it means to love God. Just give me the titles, I'll buy the books. And what I got back was, there is really nothing, I'm not sure, you could try this. And I ended up getting 2 books. One I can't even remember the title of, because when I was done reading it, I was so disgusted with it saying nothing that I threw it in the recycle bin. And the second one was written by St. Bernard of Clairvaux, called On Loving God, and he wrote it in 1128. The other one wasn't written much later. And I thought, wow, how odd, how telling. Nothing recently written on the imperative command of what it means to love God. Perhaps Paul was correct that we would move away from loving God, and maybe it's already happening, because one way that you can tell that something is being forgotten or less attention is being paid to it is if nothing is written on it for 890 years, which is about where it was. So what does it mean to love Jesus as His disciples? What could someone point to and say, now that person loves Jesus by the way that they are acting? Today I want us to look at one shape that takes, but before we do that, I'll backtrack. No, I won't. Yeah, I will. I'll backtrack and find a text in Matthew 10, okay? If you'd stand with me, turn to Matthew 10 and we'll read the verses we should have read earlier. Verses 37 to 39. Tough words. He who loves mother or father more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who has found his life will lose it. And he who has lost his life for my sake will find it. And this is the word of God. I said that what I want us to look at today is one shape that love for Jesus as his disciples can take. But perhaps you noticed that as we read these couple of verses that there are actually two shapes there, one having to do with family, the other having to do with the cross. And as I thought about these two shapes, family and the cross, I realized that I have never in my lifetime that I can recall ever heard a sermon preached on verse 37, on the family bit. But the second form of loving God in the text, the cross part, I've heard hundreds of sermons on, where taking up your cross and following Jesus and being prepared to die if necessary is heralded from the mountaintops in a nation where we have mountaintops, but where we presently have zero chance of having to die for Christ. Now, so I'm saying that we have ignored what is enormously uncomfortable as a requirement to follow Jesus, while camping on the life and death requirement of following Jesus from the safety of knowing that it will not happen here. So I'm going to reverse the emphasis this morning. I want to camp on what we ignore because we might not want to do it, and ignore what we might camp on knowing that we may never have to do it. Okay? To see this form of discipleship, that in love of Jesus that it might take, I want us to focus today on the first part and notice that Jesus zeroes in on our relational world, in particular our families. And he says in verse 37, he who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Now let's put this small piece in the larger context of Scripture. I can't cover it all, but I can give a few broad brush strokes. Because in doing so, when you read the Old Testament, for example, you can see the importance of family to God and to Israel. From God's first commandment to our first parents to go forth and multiply and fill the earth, he is talking about going out and creating families. You read the stories of great families. You read of the covenant and you see that one of the blessings of them keeping the covenant was that they would be fruitful, they would have families. That one of the punishments of breaking the covenant is that they would be barren, they would have no children, no families, and no descendants. You turn to Proverbs and you realize that a lot of Proverbs is dedicated to raising children to live in a wise manner. You put all of that together and you realize that family was and is of great significance to God since he created the institution. Go into the New Testament. Paul compares Christ's sacrifice for the church to the sacrifice that a husband ought to have for his wife, being willing to lay down his life for her. Ephesians also talks about children obeying their parents in the Lord. So given the amount of time in Scripture telling stories of families, talking about families, one can tell how important families are and marriages are to God, and how front and center they are to God's plan. Don't lose that broader, wider context as we zero down on verse 37, which is a startling contrast. He who loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son and daughter more than me is not worthy of me. We need to begin our investigation of this text by realizing that the crux of Jesus' teaching is a matter of degree. He is not talking for some kind of a polarization, either loving one or the other. He is not referring to love versus hate, but love versus loving most. So the thing that you need to understand as we explore this is that God is not telling you to stop loving your parents. He is not telling you to stop loving your children. What he is saying is that you must love must love him more than your parents and your children. Now, what might that look like? When we started exploring this whole discipleship thing, I said, you know, the content is going to be really clear. It's the application that's going to be nasty. So what might this look like? Let me give you a historical example, not an example that we should all follow, but one form that this took and one form that God greatly honored. I'm not sure whether you have ever heard of C.T. Studd or not. If you've ever studied missionary work or missions, his name would be familiar to you. In the early years, Charlie Studd, as he was then known, was a renowned English cricketer. Cricket, apparently being a sport. It is the most boring sport on earth. A game can take 2 days. It's that bad. It's like a 3-day, you know, game of Risk, only not as much fun as that. And yet he was a great cricketer, and his name would have been as well known in England as some of the sports stars that we have today are known in Canada. He not only became the Cambridge University cricket captain, but he was already pegged to play for the national team and was renowned in the record books. I saw a thing of the record and how, all of the things that I didn't understand a thing of what it said that he did in that sport. Anyway, added to his athletic ability was that his father left him an enormous fortune, which interestingly enough, he promptly distributed because he didn't want to be smothered by it. Instead, he became a missionary for Christ. His first mission venture was himself and 6 other Cambridge University students called the Cambridge Seven. They had their math right. They went to China for a number of years to be missionaries. While there, he met his wife Priscilla, wasn't his wife yet, but he married her and they had 4 daughters. Later, they returned to England, and C.T. became under the strong conviction, and so did she, that he was called to be a missionary to the heart of Africa, which at that time was incredibly dangerous because this was cannibal land. And yet he and his wife intensely prayed through it, and she said, "You go, and I'll stay here and raise funds and look after our daughters." He went for a year and came home. And then 2 years later, they were both still convinced as a result of prayer that he ought to go back permanently to Africa and she would stay in England. That was in 1913, almost a century ago. And he was my age, 52 years old. One of his friends looked at him on the night before he was to depart and said to him, "You can't be a fool at this stage in your life to give up everything you've got to say goodbye to your children and sons-in-law and your wife and move into the unknown in the heart of Africa." Charlie and Priscilla had their own struggles with the decision, but they had prayed it through. They did not discuss the implications for their marriage, but they did discuss the implications for Africa. And only years later, as they shared their journals, were they to discover how heavy-hearted they both were the week that C.T. was to leave. In fact, the night before he was to leave, very few words were exchanged between them because of the mutual fear that if they talked, they would weep and give up the calling. On the last night before he was to go, he could not even bring himself to put his arms around her because he later wrote, he was afraid that the passion in his heart would be so strong that he would never be able to break away from her. And she felt the same way. In fact, if you want to read some of the dearest letters ever written between a married couple separated, read theirs. The next morning, C.T. got into the boat. And on the first night on the boat, he writes this to her, and there are just some profound statements in here. My darling Priscilla, God was so good to keep us busy that last night and gave us glory in our souls. Let us now thank him with anticipation, not only with our lips, but also our lives. You little dream, Priscilla, of how I know you, that you paid the dearest price. I do admire you, darling, and God will give us 100-fold, and the result will be in keeping with the magnitude of the sacrifice. Goodbye, my darling Priscilla. We began risking all for God and ended as we began, loving each other utterly, only less than we love Jesus. And for the last 13 years of his life, they saw each other for 2 weeks. I'm not saying that's a model for us. I'm saying that is an example of what Jesus is talking about. In fact, as time went along, C.T. and Priscilla ended up committing themselves to founding what was first called the Heart of Africa Mission, and later became known as a worldwide evangelization crusade, today known as WEC, still existing and having led tens of thousands of African people to know Christ as their Savior. How could they do that? Well, because in prayer they determined that C.T. was to go to Africa and Priscilla was to stay at home and raise money to support his efforts. Now, this was mutually agreed upon. This was not one partner telling the other, I'm leaving you to serve Jesus for 13 years in Africa, have a good life. It's funny, but it's not, because I've heard that line used sinfully too many times as an excuse to abandon a spouse. Using an imagined call from Jesus to baptize your desire to permanently leave your spouse is just plain hogwash. Jesus will never whisper in your ear that which is contrary to what he's taught in his word. It was not in order to separate from one another that C.T. and Priscilla did what they did, but because, as C.T. wrote in the letter, and notice again the matter of degrees, we began risking all for God and end as we began, loving each other utterly, only less than they love Jesus. Then we love Jesus. It was because they loved Jesus slightly more than they loved each other that they had the freedom to serve in that way. Well, the possibility of that is rare today. For spouses to be separated for that amount of time and distance in order to obey God. But we have seen the love for Jesus more than love for family exemplified in the lives of missionaries that we have commissioned from this very stage. I think of Ron and Martha Ratzlaff. Ron served as our first executive pastor, you may recall. The first time that I sat down with him to ask him if he would be interested in that role, he told me, yes, I would be very interested in that role, but you need to know up front that God has put in mine and Martha's heart a desire to go back to Africa with the Mennonite Central Committee where they had served years before, and should that call come, we will go. But everything had changed since they had first been there. They were now had three married daughters and grandchildren, and they had aging mothers in Canada, each of them. But about 2 years after Ron started here, he and Martha sold their house, sold their cars, packed up their belongings, and moved to Kenya to be national reps for the MCC. How could they do that and leave their extended family behind? Well, because although their love for their family was powerful, their love for Jesus, and therefore their obedience to his call to Kenya, was more powerful yet. As Jesus said, it must be. These things don't just happen historically. They happen today because our love for Christ as his disciples has to be preeminent, loving each other utterly, only less than we love Jesus. Last time I was teaching overseas, there were a group of young pastoral students from the north of the country who 4 years before that had been called by God to pastoral ministry and had moved to another part of the country where I teach and committed themselves to live there and to be taught how to be pastors. And some of them unable to see their families except at New Year's, and some could not even afford to do that and had not seen their families in 4 years. One guy in particular, this fellow here, had had a baby 2 years earlier, born while he was away, preparing to serve God. And he had never seen her because he couldn't afford it, in part. I was able to provide a number of them with funds to go home for a break over the New Year's. New Year's is a big deal there. And then they would come back and do their internship somewhere else before they would then pastor. You wonder, how could he do that? Not go running home because your baby daughter has just been born. And I asked him that in a kinder way. And he told my translator, because God has called me to be his pastor. That was the first reason. And I did not have the money. But even if I did, I would not miss a chance to study. It's more important right now for me to learn to serve God as his pastor. Loving their families utterly, only less than they love Jesus. Perhaps you're wondering why I keep telling stories. Well, because I think that you are thinking of every reason why this is impossible, this is unthinkable, this is undoable, this is unreasonable for Jesus to expect, and you're writing it off as it being foolish and fanatical, when in fact it's wise and biblical. And it's being done every single day, often as a lifestyle around the world, perhaps with the notable exception of here, where it's rare. Jesus says of those who do not love him in that manner that they are not worthy of me. The modern idiom of the phrase would be that one who does not love Jesus above family doesn't have what it takes to be a disciple. And again, he doesn't say, don't love your family. He says, love me more than your family if you want to be a disciple. In the movie Tears of the Sun, there's a military coup that takes place in an African nation. Propaganda is circulated all around the globe that all of the presidential family has been assassinated, which is not true. In truth, one son seen here was saved, and efforts were being made to smuggle him to a neutral country until the rebels could be taken care of, and then he could come back and rule his nation. The rebels were trying everything they knew to kill him as well, knowing that if they could do so, they would have uncontested control of the country. So in an effort to overturn heaven and earth and capture him and kill him, they had spies with tracking devices roaming the countryside and slipping into groups of refugees who were fleeing the violence, groups that he might well join in with. One party that was fleeing the rebels did not recognize the president's son who had joined them, nor the other man who had joined their group in the last few days. What they did notice is that they were being relentlessly pursued by a rebel force who were willing to run all night long, who seemed to always know their exact location, and who were closing in on them. And at first they didn't know why, and then they realized there was a spy. He attempted to flee and was shot. And as others gathered around this dying spy, he said, "What is going to happen to my family? They have my family." What he had done was to love his family utterly, more than he loved his country or future president, that rendering him not worthy of being a citizen of that country. Jesus says that if we love our families above him, we render ourselves unworthy of being a citizen of the kingdom, of being his disciples. Those who will follow Jesus as his disciples must love him more than their family, must display a greater degree of loyalty to him than to their families. A seemingly outrageous claim, I know, but a claim staked by the only one who is divinely qualified to make it. How can he do that? Well, a claim rests on the premise of idolatry, meaning that anyone or anything that you love more than God is an idol to you. Anything or anyone that you love more than God is an idol to you, including your family. As a result, the one who created the institution of family and gave you yours deserves to be loved more than what he has created. The one who gave you the gift of family deserves to be loved more than the gift he has given. And this non-idolatrous love for him might mean following Jesus as a family. It might mean following Jesus away from a part of your family because we love each other utterly, only slightly less than we love. We love each other as a family only slightly less than we love him. Now, you might be thinking, this is really easy for you to say, telling me that I need to love God more than the children that I brought into this world, that I need to love Jesus more than the parents that gave birth to me and sacrificed to raise me. What do you really know about loving God more than family and the price of that? Plenty. I've just never felt the need to share it till now. In 2002, it was clear to Melanie and me that we were to move from Cairnport to Calgary, Briarcrest to Bethany. But it would mean splitting up our family in a way that we'd never experienced before. Layton was in grade 11 at the time, and had been given some scholarship money to come back and play football for his grade 12 year, and he wanted to graduate with his friends. That, combined with the gracious help of others, enabled us to pay the private high school fee so that he could graduate with his friends. So we moved here in July, and we moved him back there in August, and he lived with friends of ours. You know, even when my kids were teenagers, you could ask my wife, I used to play catch with a football or a baseball or take shots with a basketball or shots on a net that was worn down to nothing almost every seasonable night, which if you've lived in Saskatchewan long enough is almost every night. and why Rough Rider fans take over McMahon Stadium every year during playoff times by buying tickets off Kijiji from Calgary cold weather wimps every year. But I digress. We had done this for a lot of nights, for a lot of years. And in that entire academic year, I saw Leighton four times. No shots. Saw him four times. Two of them were Easter and Christmas, which I had to work. The third was when we went down to watch him play football and he got a concussion and I'm not even sure he knew I was there. And then graduation. I missed a year of pouring my life into him because God called me here. And although we loved our family utterly, it was still less than we loved Christ. And so we moved. We brought Ryan here to be with us to begin grade 8 in a school where his numbered grade had more students in it than the entire bunch of the school where he came from, where there was something called peer math, which was pure hell, but a year and a half jump from where he was in math, almost impossible to catch up, away from all of his friends to try to make new friends at school and church. In grade 10, he moved to Ernest Manning High School and tried to find friends there. And being shy like me, he had the results that I would have. And it broke my heart. So I said, Rye, I'll try to be your friend and your dad. And so every night, almost, we would go downstairs at about 8 o'clock and watch at least one, maybe two episodes of MASH and maybe talk together. And yet I'm not sure whether you've figured it out or not, and so I'll save you the time. You cannot be a good friend and a parent both to your teenage child. Because sooner or later it's going to break down and you're going to have to make a choice as to which one you're going to be. And the choice you must make is to be a parent. You gave birth to that child, which makes you their parent more than their friend. On top of this turmoil, he started to experience spiritual attacks, the details that I will not go into. Suffice it to say that Melanie and I had received them almost from the time we'd hit Calgary's soil, but we learned to recognize them quickly and deal with them. But a 13, 14, 15-year-old, they don't have a clue what's going on, why they're feeling the way they do. As a result, they're the weakest link in the family, which makes them the perfect target for attack. And multiple times, we prayed for him and over him and watched God release him. I still remember praying on the edge of his bed with his shoulders up that high. And I put my hand on his shoulders and prayed for him and watched them just sink as if whatever was going on just melted out his feet. But the whole thing left me physically exhausted and emotionally overextended. And for hours I would sit in the rocking chair in my office and wonder, what have I done by loving God more than my family and bringing them here? Will this ever end? Finally, in a remarkably clear way, God gave us some direction. Mel called me in the middle of the afternoon to come home and deal with the situation with Ryan that was out of control. I remember it was a Wednesday afternoon because I told the elders about it that night. And as I was on my way home, God said in my ear, clear as day, Cairnport High School. And so when I got home, he was laying on the floor and crying. And I said, Rye, do you want to go back to Cairnport? He said, yeah. And within weeks, even a week and a half, Again, with generous financial help, he was back there. And over time, the spiritual attacks lessened. And soon he was no longer touched by the slings and arrows of outrageous misfortune that I'd still moved Melanie here to face with me. I would guess that, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years has gone by since all that happened. Long, dark time. Both boys are doing well, married to wonderful wives. And none of this is to ignore the blessings that God has brought on our family and our lives since we've been here. Been remarkable blessings. But I think all of us will still bear permanent scars of different sizes and shapes because we determined that we would love each other utterly, only slightly less than we love Christ. And we moved. Being a disciple of Jesus has a joy associated with it that nothing else can reproduce. But do not think for one second that it's a joyride. In the verses that follow that we focused on, Jesus said, "He who does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. He who has found his life will lose it, and he who has lost his life for my sake will find it." Following Jesus is not a joyride. It is not a game to be played. It's not a part-time job where you pick your own hours. It's a commitment to follow Jesus and to die for him if necessary. And it means that you will love your family utterly, but if you're called to move or leave or reprioritize your life, you do so. Because although you love your family utterly, you must still love them less than you love Christ. I'd ask Jordan to come and lead us in a response.